Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For a long, long time, and for better or worse, a lot of Americans looked at the Western Hemisphere as theirs. It wasn't, of course. There are a lot of countries, but it felt that way. Well, not anymore. North and South, it's a big, globalized world in our own backyard. China's moving in, Brazil's moving up, and American sway is on the wane. This hour On Point with a big summit of the Americas coming up in Cartagena, Colombia this weekend. We look at the new order in the Western Hemisphere. Does your mental image match reality anymore? What do you see going on in the Americas? Joining me first today from Washington is Juan Carlos Lopez. He is political anchor and senior correspondent for CNN in Espanol. When President Obama travels to Cartagena this weekend for the sixth Summit of the Americas and a lot of FaceTime with regional leaders, Juan Carlos will be there. Juan Carlos Lopez, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
The president was a big hit at the last summit, two or three years ago in Trinidad and Tobago, his first. He had just recently been elected. What does he face this time as he heads off to the Summit of the Americas?
There have been changes, interesting changes. The region isn't the same as it was even in 2008. If you look back at the last 4 or 5 years, the U.S. went through a very deep recession. Latin America didn't feel the effects. There was a cliche that said that when America sneezed, Latin America would catch a cold, and that didn't happen. And you see that in the tone. You see that in the attitude of the governments. Now, there is no anti-U.S. feeling in this summit, but there is a feeling that the U.S. isn't the only big player now, and we might see that there. And it's interesting to see how President Obama will be received, but he's still a very popular figure in the region.
No anti-U.S. feeling, but there's been quite a lot of controversy over whether or not Cuba ought to be invited. It wasn't in the end, but we've got a no-show coming.
Well, it's interesting, the whole announcement by Ecuador of not going. I had the opportunity to interview Vice President Biden a couple of weeks ago after his visit to Central America, and something that he told me that really surprised me was he met with all the presidents from Central America, and none of them, he says, brought up the issue of Cuba. So some of these topics that you'll see being discussed at the summit, you have Cuba and you have the legalization of drugs, that debate, are interesting debates because people know that these are issues that probably won't go anywhere. But this is a good scenario to discuss them because usually these summits don't go anywhere more than the group picture and the opportunity for the leaders to mingle and to meet and to have a private conversation. So that's more or less the spirit of the summit. You'll have the 32 leaders in closed meetings talking about different issues, but all these summits always have their statements, their declarations. Usually they normally don't have time to sign them, and if they do, much of what is stated there doesn't really happen. So we're probably going to see the same in Cartagena.
The president of Ecuador not attending because Cuba's not invited, and we've got a bunch of countries that have just sent a message to the U.S. saying, look, the drug war has gone on for decades, and it's not working, and we should think about more legalization here. Will that be in open conversation at the summit, Juan?
Definitely. It's one of the main issues of the summit, that and Cuba. And the issue, I believe most countries are aware that drugs won't be legalized, but the tone is different. The debate is different. Secretary Clinton was very clear, and she wasn't the first to say it, but it resonated in the region when she admitted that the U.S. has a huge responsibility in the drug trade fueled by Americans' consumption of drugs. And that's part of the tone in the conversation. The countries in Central America are upset. They say, we don't produce the drugs, we don't consume the drugs, but people are dying here, and we are being taken over by the cartels. The U.S. has to do more. But it's not the conversation isn't anymore of asking the U.S. to do something for them. It is, what can we do together? How can we design the strategy together? How can you deal with your consumption? And how can the region face forward with an issue that is crippling Central American institutions? Colombia, the host of the summit, has an excellent history of dealing with this issue. Security-wise, they've made great strides. But this whole war on drugs didn't disappear the trade. cocaine still flows out of Colombia. The business model changed, and Americans are still buying the drugs. So it's something that will keep changing, and we'll probably hear in the summit. Let's see how much really comes out, because I believe the goal of the Colombians was to have this as a summit where the presidents get to talk, and statements to the public are limited, and press conferences are limited.
Two bigger and bigger factors, nations hanging over the summit. One will be attending and one not. Of course, Brazil emerging as a big global economic power and increasingly independent and influential with its own foreign policy. And then, of course, Juan Carlos, China with its enormous investments in and trade with Latin America now.
Latin America with commodities, with lots of basic materials to export. Brazil, the sixth world's largest economy. And interestingly so, the U.S. has a surplus, a trade surplus with Brazil, and Brazilians aren't too happy about that. President Rousseff was yesterday in the White House, and she was complaining about monetary policy by rich countries, and she asked President Obama to do something about it, even if it's not something that he can deal directly with. But Brazil wants to trade with the U.S. The region wants to trade with the U.S. They want a better relationship with the U.S., but it's clear that the tone is different, that the scenario is different, and that they're looking more for partnerships than to be talked down to as it had happened historically. And Brazil is a rival to the U.S., and they know it, and they want to have a bigger presence. They want to be able to export to the U.S. because right now their products are not coming into the U.S. as much as they would like to. There's a lot of tariffs and restrictions, and they'd like to change that. But if it doesn't change, they have China, they have Europe, they have other options, and they also see themselves as in a different league already with the rest of Latin America.
They have a lot of options, and they know that as they head for Cartagena along with President Obama for the Summit of the Americas this weekend in Colombia. Juan Carlos Lopez with CNN en Español will be there. Juan Carlos, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
You want to hear the sound of Latin America today? Here's a little piece of it. This is the Chinese Trade Minister, Chen Deming. This is last year in Argentina, talking about cooperation and trade between Latin America and China, how it benefits both parties.
Many Latin American countries abound in natural resources and have a strong agriculture, so they are competitive in exporting these goods. China has advantage when it comes to finished products such as clothes, shoes, caps, and electronics. Today's treaty ties between the two sides have been built gradually under the framework of free trade.
China's trade minister in Argentina. China now, of course, the number one trading partner of the region's biggest economy, Brazil. Lots of things have changed and are changing in this region. Joining us now from Miami is John Price, managing director of the consulting firm America's Market Intelligence. He's also co-editor of Can Latin America Compete? Welcome, John. Great to have you back.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
And from New York, we're joined by Christopher Sabatini, editor-in-chief of America's Quarterly and senior director of policy at the America's Society and the Council of the Americas. Christopher Sabatini, welcome. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
So give us a sense, writ large, Chris, I'll come first to you, just how over the last, I don't know, you put the time frame on it, 20 years? The relationship between the United States, its longtime dominance, has turned into something different when it comes to the Western Hemisphere, Latin America in particular.
Let's pick two arbitrary markers here. The first is the first Summit of the Americas, which was held in 1994 in Miami. And at the time, the idea was to bind the hemisphere together, all 34 elected heads of state, into somewhat what people referred to then as consensus and convergence, into a union of like-minded, democratically elected governments, and into a trade bloc that people hoped at the time would become the free trade area of the Americas. Both of those have basically evaporated. First of all, the idea that the U.S. is sort of the axis around which these economies turn is no longer true. As you mentioned, Tom, China has become very prominent. But also, these economies have also diversified the United States market overall. Brazil, through Mercosur, its trading partner in the Southern Cone, now has free trade agreements with the Middle East, with Africa, a number of Asian countries. Chile is one of the countries with the highest number of free trade agreements. So these countries, this region itself has become much more globalized. But second, as you saw and you mentioned in the case of Ecuador sitting out this summit, even the idea of this being a union of elected heads of state has begun to fray a bit. Ecuador believes that the Castro should get a seat at the table, but of course by no means are they democratically elected? So this idea of, you know, even ideological, I wouldn't say hegemony, but ideological prominence of the United States or leadership has really frayed considerably. And because of that, you're going to see when the leaders meet in Cartagena a much more contentious crowd. But also what you're going to see is a lot, as Juan Carlos said, a lot of showmanship. This is what we saw 3 years ago when Obama went to Trinidad and Tobago. It wasn't real serious issues that they discussed. In fact, the real takeaway of that was when Hugo Chavez sidled up to President Obama, hugged him, and gave him a copy of Open Veins of Latin America, this 1970s screed against U.S. imperialism. It's just a much more, I would say, assertive region, and where U.S. relevance in terms of its leadership is it's much more difficult to assert.
John, we've just got a minute before the break, but in brief, if it's not the original vision of the Summit of the Americas idea emerging here, what is it that's emerging in this very globalized period where Latin America is taking full advantage of that globalization?
Well, I think this summit is really an opportunity for Latin American leaders to voice their angst and their frustration. When Obama first addressed this audience in Trinidad, he symbolized and his rhetoric symbolized a change. A greater degree of respect would be given to Latin America. Unfortunately, that hasn't been backed up either in action or in money. I mean, money is really sort of the unspoken currency of diplomacy. And just to put it in bold figures, the Americans spend about $1.7 billion on foreign assistance, the Chinese somewhere between $3 and $5 billion, the Venezuelans $15 billion per year in the region.
Wow.
So they're being outgunned by the Chinese and the Venezuelans. And the Chinese aren't just a big trading partner. This year they will outspend the Americans and the Europeans as foreign direct investors, and they will outlend everybody. They've lent $75 billion over 4 years to the region. So
hold that thought, John. That makes it very real. We're looking at the Western Hemisphere, the Americas, and how or whether they still hold together the U.S. role here. John Price, Christopher Sabatini, please stand by. Listeners, ¿qué pasa with the Americas? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Western Hemisphere, the Americas, and whether they still hold together with any kind of American USA stamp. U.S. sway declining, Brazil soaring up, China stepping in. Christopher Sabatini joins us today. He's editor-in-chief of America's Quarterly. John Price is here, managing director of America's Market Intelligence, joins us from Miami. You can join us as well. What do you see going on in this hemisphere? Never mind the Monroe Doctrine. Is there any common story to this hemisphere anymore with a big central role for the United States? Is Latin America finding its way without the United States? And what does it mean when China is the big partner in South America, even in the Caribbean, right up to the U.S. doorstep? What's it mean when Brazil is a megapower all its own? 800-423-8255 is our number this hour. 800-423-TALK. Here's President Obama last week. He was with Canada's Prime Minister Harper and Mexico's President Calderon in Washington in the Rose Garden. Flanked by those two leaders, he talked about new partnerships since he came to office.
When I came to office, I pledged to seek new partnerships with our friends in the Americas, a relationship of equality and shared responsibility built on mutual interest and mutual respect. That's what we've done.
We'll see what the leaders say in Cartagena. Of course, around the world, everybody's noticing China in a huge way, coming for resources and much more, investing a lot, as we've just heard, and independent foreign policies emerging here as well. Iran, among others, very happy for that. Here was President Ahmadinejad in Tehran in January, preparing for a tour of Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, Ecuador, saying that Latin American nations were breaking away from the influence of the United States.
As our nation knows, we have great relations with the countries of Latin America, and those relations are expanding. The culture of those countries and their historical demands are very close to the demands of our nation. They are people with a record of anti-colonialism struggle. Even today, they are firmly standing against the oppressive powers. Oppressive powers consider this region as its own backyard and assume that they could act as they wished in that region. Today, nations are awakening and moving, and they are making their choices independently.
Awakening and moving, that's certainly true, whatever you think of Ahmadinejad as interpreter of the Western Hemisphere. John Price, help us here with just more indicators of how life, the balance of power, the balance of influence has changed in this region. Make it real for us.
Sure. Well, I'll give you a great example. The Dominican Republic was traditionally very much a client state of U.S. influence, whether it was trade, diplomacy, military support, et cetera. Today, the DR looks to Venezuela for subsidized oil. For every $100 they spend on oil, they only have to pay 40 today, and 60 is put into a long-term debt. Well, they now owe Venezuela about 40% of their foreign debt. So suddenly Venezuela has become very influential in DR politics and may even play a role in shaping the election, and which is coming up this year, as well as the next government. So that's a great example, a small-scale example of how Venezuela has sort of crept in and become a very influential player in an important ally, traditional ally, and market to the United States.
We're reading here over the weekend in the New York Times about China's economic might rolling right up to America's doorstep in the Caribbean. All kinds of loans from state banks and investments by companies, gifts there, new stadiums and roads and official buildings and ports and resorts. And then, of course, overall, Christopher Sabatini, there's Brazil with its enormous economic stature now and its increasingly independent foreign policy geostrategic view of the world.
Yeah, there are several issues here. Just to nuance a little bit about what John said and U.S. development assistance, it's important to look at two different things. The first is official bilateral development assistance, which it's true. China's, I wouldn't call it development assistance, but what it's giving in terms of aid and loans, mostly to promote its own commercial sector, is far outstripping the United States. And Brazil's own development bank is actually larger than the Inter-American Development Bank. So there are bigger players here. Mm-hmm. But U.S. private sector investment in the region still far overshadows China's. Yes, China's has grown. It will continue to grow. But I think part of this also reflects, if you will, sort of the different varieties and layers of U.S. foreign policy and influence. The private sector in the United States is still very active, and we still Latin America still consumes 23% of U.S. exports. So we're there. Mm-hmm. It's just not a sort of a big flag-flying bilateral way that we're there. And let's be honest, bilateral development assistance isn't that relevant for the countries that we most want to collaborate with on, like Brazil or Argentina. Or
they don't need it. They're on the move themselves, their own economies.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's where we get into Brazil's sort of now growing assertiveness in becoming and wanting to become a global power. We saw it when the former president, Lula, tried to broker an agreement before UN sanctions went into effect with Turkey over Iran. And we saw it also when Dilma Rousseff, shortly after President Obama was there last year, gave a very strident note about the NATO intervention in Libya. So they're clearly trying. And as you said, Tom, Brazil is a rival to the United States. They will be very open about this in writing and publicly, that they see their role as serving as a voice for developing countries and serving as trying to sort of check in some of the areas of influence in the developed world. And we see this in particular with the recent effort to get a developing country president of the IMF. Mm-hmm. And even now with the presidency of the World Bank, there are two very serious leading candidates, former finance minister of Nigeria and the former UN official, Jose Antonio Ocampo. And those, you know, there's an effort, generally speaking, in the developing world to recast global institutions, the UN Security Council also, in a way that reflects their sense of arrival at the table with the developed world. And that's going to continue. And it's not a zero-sum game, but there will be inherent frictions there.
Americans have some real sort of attitude adjustment to do when we're seeing Brazil described not just as a rising power, but as a rival to the United States. They went on to the UN Security Council. The U.S. has been kind of cool on that. We'll see how that works out. I mean, you're quite right. There's all kinds of interaction between these countries still, and especially the private sector. I mean, just looking yesterday, we saw Facebook bought Instagram, the photo sharing service, for $1 billion, and something like 100 million of that is going to a Brazilian in the U.S. who was at Stanford, Mike Krieger, who was a co-founder of Instagram. So there's all kinds of ties between these regions still. John Price, how would you describe or give us some examples of the different profile of the United States in market terms, business terms, money terms now, versus China? I mean, here's China. It is the number one trading partner with Brazil. We go back and forth sometimes, but it's at the top. What's the difference in the profile of the U.S. and China in this region?
Well, you know, by and large, as Chris pointed out, the U.S. private sector engagement in Latin America is not in any form of cahoots with the U.S. government and any policies they have, with the exception of a few industries like energy. So by and large, the private sector of the U.S. acts upon its own interests and pursues its own goals. By contrast, in China, by far, most of the foreign direct investment coming out of China are from state-owned enterprises. They're the ones with large pockets, and they're the ones with the political mandate to go abroad. They're also the ones who have a vested interest in investing and gaining access to natural resources in Latin America. And they are political by nature. So when they operate in looking at buying a mine in Peru or building a port in Chile, they are doing so under government direction as much as under profit interest.
And what is China doing when it's building a stadium in the Bahamas or a hospital or a grammar school in Dominica or power plant in Antigua? What is the point?
Sure. Well, in some of these smaller countries, there's still an interest in gaining their vote at the UN to recognize China as the single China and not recognize Taiwan. And there are still some standouts in the Caribbean basin that support Taiwan, primarily because Taiwan gives them a lot of foreign assistance of one form or the other. The other is that there is the sort of next wave of tourism around the world will be outbound Chinese tourists. That will change the tourism industry globally over the next 10 to 15 years. And the Caribbean is an interesting area, and Chinese are investing in tourism properties ahead of that wave because they're going to be largely in control of who goes where. So
What Chinese citizens go where for vacations?
Well, no, in terms of promoting which destinations. So in other words, as the Chinese get more and more comfortable with opening up outbound tourism, there will be some state control over which destinations are favored. And obviously what they want to do is they want to drive Chinese tourists to where Chinese-owned tourist assets are located, whether it's Thailand or Australia or the Caribbean. And so that's a self-serving, really, there's a collusion between private sector interest and government interest.
Well, it is really interesting what's going on here, and these are economies and outlooks moving in big ways. John Price, Christopher Sabatini, stand by. Let me bring our listeners in from Fort Dodge, Iowa. Joe is calling. Hi, Joe, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay.
Thanks for taking my call. Always enjoy listening to the show.
Great.
You know, I was going to make a point about this Puente de Amistad in Costa Rica that replaced a ferry. And just waiting, I started looking at that. And that was supported by Taiwan. So maybe my point isn't so cogent. But, you know, the point is that Taiwan and China are investing in that area of the world. And maybe we need to do some checking on who's doing what here. I know China was involved in developing the new – Costa Rica has a new national soccer stadium, which obviously Costa Rica, soccer is a big sport there.
Sure.
The soccer stadium, it was inaugurated with a visit by the Argentine national team. They bring in Lionel Messi, probably the most popular figure in the world as far as soccer fans are concerned, the only time he's ever going to come to Costa Rica. And so I just think your experts who are still stuck on, you know, Taiwan versus China, you know, I don't even know if that's the argument anymore. And
I take your point, Joe. Do you travel much in the region? And what about the American profile, the United States profile there? Have you seen it change?
I think the thing that I see is the pensionados. You know, there's a lot of Americans throughout that region and, you know, into even now Southeast Asia.
You mean retiring there, people retiring there on their pensions.
And bringing a lot of money in. And so there's a positive benefit from that. But then you have to counterbalance that from our own government foreign policy, where I know we do a lot of foreign aid and a lot of foreign development, but what gets the big news is the Afghanistans, the Pakistans, you know, where we're just going in and unfortunately tearing up people's villages. You know, I don't know. We have to get out of that mindset, I think, because China is just going in and investing in infrastructure, helping these people. So who is going to have the influence?
I take your point, Joe, and I appreciate your first-hand account there very much. Let me get one more right here from Orlando, Florida. David is calling. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Could you address the illegal immigration, and when are these Central South America that grow up absorb their poor instead of exporting it? And those people send tremendous amount of money back to those countries. Mexico alone receives $9 to $10 billion a year and brags about it.
That's an interesting thing to raise, and let us do it. Christopher Sabatini, I'll come first to you online as well. We've got people writing. William writes, I wish this region would quit exporting its poor to the USA. Now, what about this issue? And is it changing as economies develop and as other sources of support, China, Venezuela, you name it, develop in the South Americas?
Thanks, Tom, and thanks for your questions, Joe and David. Let me talk first about the issue of immigration, because it is a huge issue, and it's, you know, for U.S. Foreign policy in the region, it's really a third rail. We see this in the Republican primary debates. We see it in the U.S. debate generally about what to do with the 11 million of undocumented immigrants in the United States, and the way we talk about them, the way we discuss them, seriously affects the way we're perceived and our influence in the region. First of all, it's important to recognize that, you know, immigration has helped fuel our economic growth here. It's responding to a labor demand in our market that is unmet. And so many people are coming here because they're drawn here. And we're continuing to see that. And let's face it, our immigration system is broken. We cannot provide enough channels for legal documented immigration, and we have security issues, which unfortunately Obama has also become the deportation president, as John said earlier on an earlier conversation, not this one. And I agree. So we've got this twin problem of how to resolve formally our immigration problems in terms of allowing immigrants in to be able to respond to our labor market
demands.
Does
it self-resolve at some point as economies grow in Latin America? People just turn around and go the other way. I mean, I've seen some numbers that's happened with Mexico in the last year, I think.
Yeah, you're right, Tom. You're seeing in Mexico a sort of a net reverse flow of undocumented immigrants back to Mexico. And that's true. With the U.S. Recession, there's been a reverse flow. But, you know, there are many immigrants here, documented and undocumented, who have families here. There are 5 million children who were born here or are undocumented that have undocumented parents. So they've grown up here, either being born here or having come here at a young age, that they can't go back. Their life is American. They're firmly woven into U.S. society. What we do with those, is those 5 million children, the 11 million undocumented immigrants, is going to be a very difficult problem. And you're right. These countries have to be able to grow to be able to sustain their own populations. And that's going to be a problem. And they're troubled with, and we're looking at a real serious issue in the case of what are now called in the region ninis. Those are youth between the age of 15 and 28 who are neither working nor studying. And estimates place that number at about 20 million young people in the Americas who aren't working and aren't studying. What's going to happen to them and how those economies will absorb them is going to become a serious challenge. And yes, it's true. They could very well find it much more enticing, especially as the U.S. economy begins to pick up to immigrate to the United States.
Of course, we've got our own knees by that definition in this country. Samantha in Windsor, Connecticut. Thanks for calling, Samantha.
Hi. I wanted to know if you were going to address the treatment of Latin Americans in the U.S., either legal or illegal. They get treated pretty bad with referring to them as taking people's jobs and so on. So do you think they'd address that?
Yeah, let us pick it up. John, what about that treatment, and does it affect the American reception, the U.S. reception in Latin America?
Yeah, I mean, the migration question is so laden with misinformation. Picking up on what Chris said and related to what the caller just asked about, there are more people. Latin America this year will absorb more people than it will export people. So the days of exporting people for the moment is over, and I think that trend will continue for a while because the growth in Latin America far outstrips that of the United States, and because U.S. enforcement, post 9/11 legislations, which now allow fingerprints of, say, a sheriff in Arizona who arrests someone, gets checked with the national database, and if they're deemed to be a non-resident, they're immediately deported. And about 200,000 Central Americans and Mexicans were deported last year, another 400,000 left of their own volition, versus about 400,000 that entered the country. So we're losing Mexicans and Central Americans. And why is that important? It's important because those people, by and large, are single men who are in the most productive years of their economic life. They are net contributors to the U.S. economy. They are huge surplus contributors to the Social Security funding. They are huge contributors to the federal tax base. They unfortunately, that money doesn't trickle down to local government where they draw from in terms of education and hospitals.
John Price, but please stand by. We've got a break right here. We'll come back and look at that and much more, the drug war and beyond. We're looking at the Western Hemisphere, U.S. sway declining, Brazil soaring up, China stepping in. Listeners, what do you think? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Western Hemisphere on the eve of the Summit of the Americas. U.S. sway declining, Brazil soaring up globally, China stepping in an enormous way into what was for many, many decades considered the United States' backyard, for better or worse. Christopher Sabatini joins us today from New York. He's editor-in-chief of the America's Quarterly. John Price is here, managing director of America's Market Intelligence consulting firm, joins us from Miami. You can join us as well. What does it mean when China is the big partner in South America, in the Caribbean? And do we think too much about drug war and immigration, too little about trade, shared interest? Is it just not our backyard, in air quotes, anymore? And what should Obama's message be to the hemisphere at the big summit this weekend? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Let's hear from Eduardo calling from Montreal in Canada. Hi, Eduardo. You're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom. Precisely the problem with the United States, and when they have this fixation with the drug war. So the biggest export of Latin America to the United States is the narcotics. But the Chinese, they have a different approach. They don't have the historical legacy of the great European powers, the imperialistic powers of Europe and America, and they come into Latin America without this baggage of the Cold War. And they are ideologically compatible to trade with all countries, including Cuba, Venezuela. And these countries, they give them contracts. They get very substantial foreign aid from the Chinese. Mm-hmm. The Chinese get the Chinese companies to work in Latin America. And it is a perfect marriage without the ideological struggle. It is also a great historical irony that the United States spending decades and hundreds of millions, if not billions, to keep out a great communist power, which was Soviet Union, from the region,
right.
Sees now a China, a great capitalistic power with a communist ideology holding such great influence in this backyard of America.
That is really some kind of irony, of course. It's a new creature all its own in the last couple decades. But that's an interesting observation. Christopher Sabatini, what about this notion of China and Latin America as the perfect marriage versus a troubled marriage with the U.S.? I don't know. Respond.
I guess it depends on your vision of marriage, whether you're an optimist or a pessimist. This comes with risks. And it's true that China is coming in large, as you said, Tom and John said. But Eduardo, you're right as well. But there are risks for Latin American governments, first of all, in countries. First is the resource curse. As you said earlier, China is consuming mostly raw materials from Latin America. 90% of Argentina's exports right now to China are actually soy or soy-based products. Most of the iron ore, for example, that Brazil ships to China is put on ships that are made with Brazilian iron ore but were constructed and manufactured in China. And we all know from our days of development economics in the 60s and 70s that the only way to really move up the global value chain is to move away from just exporting natural resources to actually adding value to those resources.
But isn't that happening? I mean, look at Brazil. They've got some very sophisticated industries growing up there.
They do. But if you look at, we recently did in America's Quarterly an analysis of market share. And actually, Chinese manufactured products are cutting in, even in Brazil, by about 25%. Cutting in areas of light manufacturing goods, cheap electronics, and textiles into Brazilian industry. And you're already beginning to see the backlash. Brazil has now passed a law that prevents Chinese or foreign companies from owning land in Brazil. And there have been a series, and Argentina has lodged a series of trade complaints against unfair Chinese trade practices. So it's not a rose path here. It is fraught with a lot of competition and will get worse. There's another problem here as well. Chinese assistance, commercial, I wouldn't call it again development assistance, has increased. It is mostly done behind closed doors, and it's usually tied to long-term receipts from natural resource trade.
It's a deal, in other words.
So, for example,
you offer us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, $40 billion recently for Ecuador, but paying paying back on that debt is going to come from Ecuador's oil exports to China over the course of decades. That is all done behind closed doors, direct government to government, and it's not sort of done in the way that U.S. investment or Western European investment occurs in a more transparent way that people can see what's happening. And people can see sort of how the government is committing to those loans.
John Price, is there a risk of the U.S. being locked out by deals like that over time?
Absolutely. I mean, when you're a government that lends billions of dollars to another government and you're also competing for government bids in that country, there's going to be leakage. There's going to be influence peddling by the lender country to make sure its companies are the chosen ones for those bids. So that obviously the U.S. companies, European companies, they have to operate under the auspices of transparency laws, and they simply can't compete with that. More importantly, a bigger at stake here is really the trade system of the Americas and democracy building. And Chinese power, although if it's balanced with U.S. power, is a positive thing. But if governments like Venezuela, Ecuador, Nicaragua, which were really beaten up by the financial crisis and began – there was a real questioning amongst its voters as to the viability of their systems. Now they're being propped up by Chinese money, and therefore that just gives a pass to leaders in those countries to continue their undemocratic ways or untransparent ways. And that is a danger, I think. That sends a wrong message to emerging leaders, to newly elected officials, to those trying to cling and stay on to power, that, hey, if they strike a deal with the Chinese, they might be able to keep and stay in power longer. And I think that's a dangerous path for Latin America.
Let's look at it from a Latin American perspective for a moment here, not, you know, who's going to dominate, but what about their own way forward? I mean, we've got some very skeptical listeners on U.S. influence there over time. Here's one writes online, after years of CIA-led coups and rebellions and assassinations throughout Central and South America, this listener writes, it's good to see Latin America breaking free of the corrupt shackles of U.S. hegemony. With their increasing economic stature of some and others moving up, can Latin America stand on its own feet here, Christopher Sabatini, and not be kneeling in any direction, not to China, not to the U.S.? Is that path opening?
Yeah, I think this should be understood entirely as a net positive for both the United States and Latin America. This newfound economic strength, their global assertiveness is really a good thing. I think the United States is a series of growing pains in how to relate to this. We saw this actually yesterday with President Rousseff, with President Obama in the White House. The body language was a little chilly.
Yes.
And they really didn't walk away with much, I don't think. And I think in part of that was reflecting sort of her reaction to being chided in the way she has been over position on Libya and Syria. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know,
where Brazil has been opposed to intervention by, let's say, the West or the world.
They've exactly. been kind of on the... And I think U.S. hasn't quite really come to accept that. But I think it's a positive. I think it helps, if you will, sort of democratize the global system and provide for a buffer that, you know, U.S. cannot unilaterally assert its influence. The issue is also, as you mentioned, is the three main topics that the U.S. really is driving its agenda with Latin America are three big hot topics in U.S. domestic politics. One is drugs. Yes, we've accepted responsibility, but we really haven't done much to ban assault weapons, which are the source of most of the violence in Mexico. We really aren't addressing the drug problem in the United States as a healthcare problem the way we should. Immigration, as we heard from David and Joe, still is a huge outlier, and Samantha as well. And the last is trade. We want to be a trade leader, but every trade deal that we've negotiated, we now have 11 in the hemisphere, has been an uphill battle with our U.S. Congress because of resistance and fear about free trade for U.S. jobs.
And meanwhile, Latin America putting some of its own trade organizations together. Nanette in Franconia, New Hampshire. Thanks for calling, Nanette. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been listening, and it sounds like your callers are really, I mean, your guests are really concentrating on the powerful in South America and Latin America, whereas I have been working with the Hondurans for the past 2 years. I've
yes.
made six trips, mm-hmm. and they certainly cannot stand on their own 2 feet. Until recently, the planes that I was on coming out of Miami were full of church volunteers bringing vital aid and medical care, operations, everything that they can't do on their own.
Good for you.
The last two trips in November and this past January, no one else was on the plane. The Peace Corps has pulled out. And these people are so poor, and now they're just getting poorer. Their tourism is decimated, and it's all because of the drug traffic, terrorism that's going on down there. I saw it the first time myself in our little town where we go, where everyone knows us. There was actually a drug-related murder where the waitress in our hotel's son was caught in the crossfire and shot in the leg. Mm. And this just never happened before. And, you know, I think people don't think about Honduras. You know, they don't think about the poor countries. Maybe they think about, I don't know, Costa Rica because it's pretty or whatever. But these people in Honduras are the policies. They are bearing the brunt of our lack of responsibility.
But what does that mean, Nanette? Should the U.S. has been pretty interventionist on drug policy. Should it be even more so, or are you suggesting something else?
Frankly, I don't know. I don't know how you protect a small little country like that. But every time that we're successful partnering with Mexico, you just push the people further, and the drug traffickers further and further into the woods, into the forests, into the jungles, I guess they are. And nobody care. I don't see anybody helping Honduras.
Nanette, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Pushed into villages where people are living with not much, not really in on the economic growth. I mean, what about this? Christopher, I'll come first to you. We see leaders of these countries, including some of those closest to the United States, the Colombian president, the Mexican president, the Guatemalan president, former military guy, saying we've got to have a different kind of drug war, and even talking about much more legalization of drugs as one path forward, saying enough with these, 4 decades now nearly of drug war. Where's that turning, Chris?
Well, I think it's, you know, the debate is getting healthier in the sense, again, that I think countries are beginning to question U.S. policies, beginning to push, and the U.S. is beginning to realize that the dire situation, especially in Central America, as Nanette pointed out. I mean, there are a couple of countries. Guatemala is another one that are really at the risk of becoming failed states, narco states, at the level of penetration of narcotics groups into state authority, and the level of lawlessness is severe. I'm not sure, to be honest, the question of legalization of drugs really addresses that. That's a long-term issue. But I do think the United States has been, and also the region, has been terribly remiss in trying to forge some sort of pan-regional strategy on drugs. Because this isn't, as you said, Nanette, in Central America, this transcends borders. It's not like Colombia, where we had an $8 billion Plan Colombia that effectively dismantled some of the large trafficking organizations. It still produces cocaine, as Juan Carlos said earlier, but it's no longer a threat to the state. In Central America, the United States needs to step up. It needs to collaborate with its neighbors. Luckily, in the meeting that you mentioned, Tom, or quoted from with Calderon and Harper, they did pledge more support for Central America because these are states, countries that are very much at risk. And I think the United States has to step up with much more assistance and a lot more transnational information sharing.
John, what about the security and development picture here? Nanette looks at the poverty, and at the same time, you know, Chris writes about the region being overrun and outgunned by criminal syndicates. This isn't a region that's far away. I mean, it may be a globalized world, but proximity still does matter. These are our neighbors. Do you see some kind of change that addresses in a new, more effective way the poverty factor, the criminal and drug factor?
Well, and as she pointed out, the Central America is a real exception to all the positive trends that we've been talking about. Central America doesn't have natural resources. It's not profiting from high resource prices. One-third of Honduran families have no father at home because they either left to go to El Norte, to the States, to work, or they were killed in violence. And so young men, teenage boys, are growing up without a father figure. And frankly, the economic options for them are few. So they get drafted into gangs. Mm. And if they do make it to the States and they're caught in some sort of net operation, then they're going to be deported back. And part of this uptick in deportations from the United States back to Central America has really brought back hardened criminals back to Central America. And Central America and these gangs are competing with the Mexicans to be the conduit of drugs from Colombia and Peru into the United States. As the Mexicans become more effective at clamping down, more and more airstrips are opening up, in clandestine airstrips are opening up in Central America to move drugs. And it is a problem that no government in Central America is powerful enough, even the Costa Ricans, to police and effectively govern through. And so this is going to be a growing problem. And I don't think, frankly, that the Americans or anyone else has really woken up to how big a tragedy it is. And, you know, our caller put in very human terms what it means on the ground. But collectively, that's a real threat to the region and to democracy.
It's really interesting. The U.S. with the sort of cartel land here on its doorstep, stuck with that problem or facing that problem. Meanwhile, the more buoyant economies going off in their own directions, with China in the middle of those, more in South America. Where does this take us, Chris Sabatini? Look down the road here a little further. I mean, you know, proximity on the map looks real important, and it's important when there's crime on your doorstep or poverty on your doorstep. But is it possible that South America drifts away from the United States, really just goes into other orbits or its own, quite fully independent and sometimes almost anti-U.S. in its global outlook?
It's a good question, Tom, and I think you're absolutely right. Is what we're seeing is this, you know, somewhat arbitrary geographic alliance, which is always the way it's is beginning to fracture. The sense that because we sort of share the same hemisphere, we share the same values and destiny and interests, is really beginning to change. And you see this also with the proliferation of new regional organizations that, where the U.S. is pointedly not included. There's the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR, which is really a forum for Brazil to be able to assert its regional influence. They recently formed CELAC, a Latin American sort of organization of American states without Canada and the United States. Wow. There's also talks of other sorts of networks that really demonstrate that really they've become a lot more assertive and independent. But as you say, this is a very diverse region. And, you know, you have one of the world's poorest countries, Haiti, with now the sixth most important economy in the world, Brazil. There's very little that binds them. And I think, you know, what the U.S. is increasingly going to need to do is to find ways to work with some of these larger powers to be able to work in some of these more developed areas. And we saw this breakdown in the case of Honduras and the coup in 2009, where really Brazil and the United States locked horns on this and didn't resolve it effectively.
It's a whole new profile and absolutely fascinating. We're grateful for your briefing as we get ready for President Obama to fly into the Summit of the Americas in Cartagena, Colombia. Very grateful to you. Christopher Sabatini with America's Quarterly. Sir. Thanks for joining us. And John Price with America's Market Intelligence. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.